Welcome, Dumbheads, to this week's Megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one episode per day, identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Heroes Unlimited, the gloriously ramshackle superhero RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the week's previous episodes in one Megasode, like this one. If you'd like to play along at home, we're reading Heroes Unlimited Revised Second Edition, second printing, from December 1998. Today we're discussing page 342 of Heroes Unlimited, and I don't like it. not this page. I mean, I don't like this page, but I don't like that we're discussing it. As you'll know if you listened to last episode, last time, over half of the material on that page was stuff that was in Ninjas and Super Spies, so we've already talked about it on the podcast. As a result, we didn't have to talk about Heroes Unlimited yesterday. We got to talk about transdimensional TMNT. We got to talk about a charming mutant mastodon man with a delightful head of hair. It was a wonderful treat, a great vacation from this book. I've got to tell you, when I got to this page in my PDF, I was all ready to make this a transdimensional TMNT page. So I got out my highlighter and I went through line by line. I had my PDF of Ninjas and Super Spies up as well. And I went through and I combed through and I found everything that's on this page of Heroes Unlimited that also appears in Ninjas and Super Spies and Dumbheads. It was so close to half. It was so close to 50%, which is my self-imposed arbitrary breakpoint. Once it's 50% or more, then I do transdimensional TMNT. As always, I am a slave to my own whims. Once I have set myself an arbitrary restriction, I cannot break it. And I'm sad to tell you that this page is so very nearly, but not quite, 50% old content. Therefore, we're doing it. We're talking about this page. What's here? Well, there's a big list of explosives, like dynamite, plastic explosives, hand grenades, mortar shells, that appeared in Ninjas and Super Spies. There's also a list of body armor, ancient body armor, that appeared in Ninjas and Super Spies. And then we got some random shit that you might want to hit somebody with, like brass knuckles, a cattle prod, a blackjack, which, by the way, is number one, not mechanically differentiated from a club, and number two, nonetheless, appears separately on the table later in this section that includes both clubs and blackjacks. So, good fucking thing we've got double extra redundancy on our mechanical implementation of random object used to whomp people on the head. We've got crowbars on this page. That's something. I'm sorry, I say crowbar. This is much more sophisticated than that. Quote, SWAT entry tool, aka hooligan tool. A long, 1-inch thick, stress-proof bar, heat-treated for durability and strength. On one end is a large chisel, spike-like pry bar. On the opposite end is a claw-slash-chisel point, crowbar-like, used to pry open security doors and grills. Cost, $240. Damage, 1d8, either end. Pops normal door locks on a roll to strike of 8 to 20. Pops heavy locks and security door locks on a roll to strike of 12 to 20. So here we have a pry bar with a short set of prying rules included, which make prying a grate off a door dependent not on your strength, as you might expect, or on your familiarity with the SWAT tool, aka hooligan tool, if you're of the chaotic persuasion, but it actually depends on, like, your martial arts training, like your strike bonus, so the better you are at kung fu, the better you are at prying open doors with a crowbar. Great rule. I'm glad I read it, and I'm glad that it's taking up space in this book where there was no room for goddamn guns. Hey, you know what else is sitting on this page, being an excellent use of space? Another implementation of itching powder. Remember in the magician section, the stage magician has access to itching powder. You may recall that the stage magician, this access to things like goblin dust, itching powder, is like one of their main traits, because they're basically for shit, but they've got a few good skills, they can juggle, and they have the special stage magic connections to buy things like paper bags full of ashes. One of the things that they have special access to is itching powder. Yet lo and behold, here we are in the general equipment section that everybody can buy equipment from, and here's itching powder. But in the game's defense, it's not the same itching powder. It is slightly different itching powder. Both are effectively worthless. Both are terrible attacks, terrible waste of an action to use. But it is true, the stage magician, per these rules, has access to a slightly better formula of itching powder than the general population. This is a small victory, sadly the only kind of victory a stage magician can probably hope for in this game where he is surrounded by immortal beings and military hardware. And you know what? The magician deserves it, because this equipment section, you know, it's just for general purpose equipment that everybody can buy. Like, for example, it lists mace, because if there's one problem the superheroes in this game don't have, it's fucking vanity. Superheroes in this game use guns, They wear helmets, and they're not above macing your ass if their superpowers aren't up to snuff for crime fighting. You will get pepper sprayed by superheroes in the world of Heroes Unlimited. But you know what? Maybe you can't afford mace, or you don't want to be caught carrying mace, or there's a superhero fight backstage at a strip club and you got to improvise. You'll be happy to know that this page does list combat stats for hairspray, including, yet again, more rules for blinding people, the effective range of a can of hairspray, 3 feet, the duration that you can blind someone with hairspray, 1d4 melees, and the cost of a can of hairspray, $3. So for those of you keeping track at home, when it comes to equipment, Heroes Unlimited has 2 stat blocks for different formulations of itching powder, 1 stat block for hairspray, 2 stat blocks for military web belts to hold firearms in, but alas, no firearms. No room. I hope your weapons expert character likes burning people alive with hairspray and a lighter, like the end of Metal Gear, because that's what he fucking gets. Oh, and he gets knives, too. I guess that's the dumbest thing on this page. This page lists knives. There's a whole section for them. Modern knives. And which modern knives are on offer, you ask? Well, there's the combat bush knife that does 1d6 damage. The slim pack throwing knife that does 1d6 damage. The belt throwing knife set. This is a set of 4 knives that do 1d6 damage. Don't forget the polycarbonate knife that does 1d6 damage. And of course the bayonet that does 1d6 damage. Oh, and the small boot knife that does 1d4 damage. So if you're looking for the only knife in the goddamn world that's worse than other knives, can I interest you in a boot knife? Putting aside the boot knife, which is $20 and does 1d4 damage, so it meets the extremely low criteria for being like different enough from other knives to maybe deserve its own stat block. This is 12 lines on this page devoted to mechanically identical knives. They vary in price, they vary in flavor, but they are all knives that do 1d6 damage. And when I say they vary in flavor, they vary in weird flavor. Like, you can buy the slim pack throwing knife. Quote, with a flat lambskin sheath, this knife is perfect for concealment. Also a perfectly balanced 6-inch blade. No knife, however slim, can be described as perfect for concealment when it is 6 inches long and shows up on metal detectors. You can't get that shit into an airport. For that, you would need the polycarbonate knife. Quote, this 7-inch knife with silk sheath is guaranteed not to show up on metal detectors. Balanced for throwing, yet with a keen edge for slicing. All this shit about throwing and slicing and balance means nothing. Means nothing. Because, number one, there's no like rules implementation of this. There's no mechanical weight to it at all. Secondly, there's no basis for comparison. Because you know what the other knives in this game, all the many countless knives that all do 1d6 damage, you know what they're balanced like? You know how they throw? Exactly the fucking same. As far as we know, maybe there's a knife out there that has 90% of its weight in the tip, and you can balance it on your finger like one of those toy birds that balances on its beak, and its shape and balance are so fucked up that if you throw it, then it just like spirals immediately down into the left and crashes into the ground. Maybe that knife exists, is somewhere in the undifferentiated mass of knives that do 1d6 damage, but it doesn't matter because they've got exactly the same stats. And hey, maybe there's a knife somewhere in that undifferentiated mass of 1d6 knives that is even better balanced, even better for throwing. Doesn't matter. If you don't find a knife anywhere here that's to your liking, you could say to the GM, hey, I have an idea. What if I bought a special super knife called the Death Raptor, and it comes in an eagle skin sheath, and its aerodynamics were designed by a team of MIT physicists, and it threatened to disrupt the knife industry, and the lab was burned down by Big Knife, and this is the only surviving prototype. If you asked the GM for that, he'd be like, yeah, sure. Who cares? Because there's one set of knife stats. It doesn't matter. The only difference is the fucking sheath. That's the only balance factor, is am I charging you appropriately for whatever the fuck your knife sheath is made out of? Other than that, these knives are all the same. You know, aside from like the little special features like can't see it on a metal detector, little tiny things about the fiction like that, or significant things in the fiction, like, for example, a knife that you can fire out of its base so that the blade becomes a projectile. This is the case with the firing combat knife illustrated on this page, which you can't buy. There was no room for that one. The one knife that there's something significant different about it, the knife that you can shoot like a gun, the most amazing and ridiculous development of blade technology since the fucking gun blade, that's pictured on this page, but like the guns pictured at the beginning of the section, there was no room to actually stat it or give you a price. It's just another picture of a cool thing you can't have, courtesy of your friends at Palladium. So that's 2 web belts, 2 itching powders, 1 can of hairspray, 5 knives so far, there are more to come in another section, and no guns in Heroes Unlimited. Just unbelievable. The dumbest thing on this page, I don't know. I mean, I want to say it's the knives, because they take up 12 lines, to describe four knives that are functionally identical, and that offense is aggravated by the fact that they take up extra space because the game feels the need to, for some reason, specify what kind of material the sheaths are made out of. Like, why do I care that your throwing knife is in a lambskin sheath, you weirdo? It's like, Heroes Unlimited by Kevin Zambita, additional material by Unpleasant Man on Bus, Dubious Fellow in Pawn Shop, your middle school friend who definitely doesn't actually own a knife. But I guess at the end of the day, I gotta give it to Hairspray. In a game with no space for even one firearm, three lines are devoted to the combat stats of Hairspray. That's in a certain way beautiful, but it's also dumb as shit. So I guess I have to pick that. Today we're discussing page 343 of Heroes Unlimited. We are still in the equipment section. As we've been discussing, this section, you know, it's a bit of a dud to end this book, which has been so gonzo, so interesting in so many ways, so loaded with weird crap, that, you know, it's kind of a disappointment that the book ends with an equipment section that not only doesn't measure up to Heroes Unlimited Revised, lacking as it does things like guns, military vehicles, but also for podcast purposes, this is a lot of stuff that we've seen before in Ninjas and Super Spies, and therefore there's nothing really to say about it. For example, on this page, we have modern armor, which we've seen before. All kinds of night vision and infrared optics, thermo imagers, stuff we've seen before. I haven't thoroughly checked this page, but I think all of it may be material that appeared in Ninjas and Super Spies. Certainly more than half of it is, and you know what that means. While Heroes Unlimited may disappoint us, transdimensional TMNT never will. And on days when there is less than half new material on a page of Heroes Unlimited, we discuss the most wonderful thing from a random page of transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles instead. So let's get straight to that. I'm rolling the dice now. All right, that's a 26. The page before the last transdimensional TMNT page we looked at, this page sadly has no pictures of mammoths with delightful haircuts on it. That's an automatic 10% off. The best this page can get now is a B. However, it's still pretty good. You have to look a little harder, but if you do, you'll find that this page is the beginning of the prehistoric mammal section. This is the section that's going to give us the Hyaenodon, the Mastodon and Woolly Mammoth, the Megatherion or Giant Sloth, which I'm looking forward to talking about at some point, should we happen to roll it. And on this very page, at the beginning of the prehistoric mammal section, we find Diatramon, which sounds like a creature that would help a beloved child to find himself in the first season of Digimon. However, Diatramon is not that. Diatramon is also not what is described here. First of all, Diatramon is not a mammal. Secondly, the author of Transdimensional TMNT, while he did his homework, was working with some bad information. Although, you know, let's put bad in quotation marks. The bad information here is much better than the good information that you can find nowadays on the internet. Let me just read you what this book says Diatramon is. Quote, a hunting ground bird, Diatramon, sometimes called the, quote, terror crane, used running speed to pursue prey and powerful claws and beak to kill. Variations. Relatives include the modern ostrich and emu. Another related predator was Forosrachos longissimus, somewhat smaller, size level 8, and with an eagle-like beak. Extinct vegetarian cousins include giants like Epyornis maximus. Believe it or not, I've never said Epyornis maximus before. Of course, I've read it many times. A size level 18 browsing bird, and Deinornis giganteus, the tallest known bird, with a height of up to 12 feet. Now, it turns out this material is wrong, but I love it nonetheless. It is my truth. Like, I'm never really going back to dinosaur days, and I'm not a paleontologist. So who cares? What is true is what is useful, and what is useful to me is the motherfucking terror crane. So this bad boy is basically a dire chocobo, a big, 7-foot-tall, bipedal, running bird, a prehistoric relative of the ostrich and emu. It runs down prey, grabs him with its claws, and then it beaks him to death. And then if you want to use these stats to play something a little bit different, depending on what your particular taste in birds is, you could play the Forosrachos, which has got a beak like an eagle, or you could play Deinornis giganteus, which is the tallest of all birds, up to 12 feet tall. That's like a little bit of info for the GM to have in his back pocket. So if you've got a player who's thumbing through transdimensional TMNT and nothing's catching their interest, because I guess they're dead inside, and then they just close the book and look to you and say, what's the tallest bird? I want to be the tallest bird. You can say, I got you covered, bro. Deinornis giganteus. Oh yeah? Sounds good. Tell me all about it. Well, it's a Deinornis, and it's giganteus. What else do you want? Nothing. I'm sold. Now, later research apparently has shown, because I did Google this bird. I mean, how could I not Google terror crane? First of all, I'm happy to report that it appears terror crane stars in some books. someone had the idea of writing a sort of, monster, like horror thriller or something, where a terror crane comes from the distant past to the present and hunts people. So that's cool. Maybe at some point, when I'm looking for something to put on this feed and I'm between Palladium books, I'll go read Terror Crane and let you guys know how it is. However, outside the realm of niche Kindle-ready monster books, the Diatramon is not really all this. As it turns out, according to my research, somebody who wrote about this creature in 1970, Cretin, I think was his name, coined the term Terror Crane to describe what he interpreted as like this big fuck-off killer bird. But now we tend to think this creature was like a peaceful plant eater with a non-hooked beak. It had something more like hooves than talons. Sounds boring to me. I mean, I'm a tall, awkward vegetarian with no particular combat prowess. I don't need more of that in my life. You know what I need in my life? One guess. That's right. Terror cranes. You don't just get the real world stuff about the terror crane either. Well, the real world stuff. The fake real world stuff. You don't just get that. You also get, as usual, a description of what your terror crane will look like post-mutation, after Diatramon has evolved into Were-Garuru Diatramon. Because if you take no human looks at all, then you just look like a terror crane. A plain old terror crane. Quote, eyes on the side of the head, large parrot-like beak with nostril holes, feathered body is squat and muscular, with long bare legs ending in large feet. I really like the detail that it's a squat, feathered body, but long legs. So you don't look like a monster eagle, you look like a monster budgie on stilts. All the better to terrify your foes. But if you evolve some more human looks, maybe even go full looks, so that you're just like a human who looks a little bit terror crane-ish, then here's what you get. Quote, rounded eyes, hooked, pointed nose, and hard mouth. I really like that hard mouth. That's like an attitude thing. Partly physiology, but also partly just an innate propensity for mean mugging. The crane has faded, but the terror remains. On top of that, you get, quote, long stringy hair, long athletic legs with oversized feet. Again, long stringy hair, more of a choice that you make, typically in a human being, right? You can't exactly choose how stringy your hair is, but you can certainly choose how long it is. You certainly will choose long if you're a terror crane, because you are the most fucking metal of birds. This might as well say you wear a black t-shirt with some kind of skull on it, some kind of devil on it, maybe, because that's just who you are. You're a terror crane. You're a terror crane, you have a band called Terror Crane, and you don't wash your hair, and you eat raw meat, and you give people mean looks. I love it. This is like a whole character concept. It's like, you know, in improv, sometimes you go into something not so much with like character background or like concrete ideas, but you go in with like a mood, you go in with a feel, like some kind of motive force to the scene. This gives you that. Don't even think about who your character is or where they come from. Just go into a scene with a sour look on your face, thinking a single phrase, Terror Crane. That's a character. It's all you need. Anyway, that's it for today. The Diatramon is the most wonderful thing on page 26 of Transdimensional TMNT. Join me tomorrow for more equipment we've already talked about, and you know what that means, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 344 of Heroes Unlimited. We are still in the equipment section, which has been a big disappointment so far. We started things off with a bang, ironic pun intended, on the first page with the discovery that there are no guns in this gun-obsessed book. And since then, it's been pretty much page after page of equipment that we've already seen in Ninjas and Super Spies, with the not disappointing result that we've been talking a lot about transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, as indeed we will today. Just to keep you up to speed on what's going on in Heroes Unlimited as we're skipping through these pages, this one contains communications equipment, including an adorably quaint description of what a cellular phone is, and then it's got a bunch of surveillance equipment, some of which is actual surveillance equipment, some of which is just microphones, like a lavalier mic, for example, and some of which is shit that I have no idea what it is, because I'm a nerd, but not that kind of nerd, and so don't ask me what a low-frequency converter, a test transmitter, an additional transducer, or a telephone induction unit are. I really don't know, and no explanation is forthcoming here. Remember pages ago when we were getting, like, multiple sentences of description about what kind of material the sheath of each knife was made of in the knife section? Could have really used some of that space here to explain to me what a telephone induction unit is. I mean, maybe I'm a dumbass now for not knowing, but I cannot be held responsible for not knowing when I originally read this book when I was like 12 or 13 years old. That's your target audience. You gotta tell them what a telephone induction unit is. If indeed it is important enough to take up space in this book, I wouldn't like to venture a guess on that since I have literally no idea what I'm talking about right now. Anyway, this is all stuff that we've talked about before, and you know what that means. It's time once again to delve into the pages of Transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and discuss the most wonderful thing on a random page of that book. I'm rolling the dice now. Alright, that's a 91, and this is an interesting portion of Transdimensional TMNT, and not only because there are three wonderfully illustrated bee paramilitary troopers. I don't know how else I can say this. They're bees. They're holding high-tech, looks like submachine guns. One of them has a pair of grenades hanging adorably from his little bee neck. It's a great picture. But it has nothing specifically to do with the contents of this page, which are about running a multi-dimension campaign. This is a great example of how transdimensional TMNT is different from other Palladium books. It's totally in keeping with the spirit of, let's say, Heroes Unlimited, to say there are a whole bunch of different dimensions that your characters could visit by using spells or dimensional transport machines. Maybe there's a superpower that skips between dimensions, and you might find all kinds of strange things on the other side. And if this were Heroes Unlimited, that would be followed by like a quick sentence that would say, for example, you could have anything from our other books, Nightbane, Rifts, Recon, Valley of the Pharaohs, the Palladium Compendium of Modern Weapons, which isn't specifically relevant, but it's a great book, Scrapers, Invasion of the Mechanoids, etc., etc., etc. And that's all it would be. It would be the bare idea, hey, go visit other dimensions. And then, you want to know what's out there? Maybe something from one of our other books. Who knows? Anyway, moving on. Not so transdimensional TMNT. When it drops a cool idea, like let's do a campaign where we're dimension hopping mutant animals, it then backs it up with a lot of well thought out advice. It's got gonzo, but it's also got follow through, which is something that is sorely lacking in a lot of the tired vanilla gonzo stuff coming out in role playing, even up to the present. Big ideas that are just a grab bag of mismatched keywords and no follow through. Welcome to the pirate zombie planet. And that's it. Here what we get though is, okay, so you're gonna run a campaign with lots of different dimensions and the characters can travel through them. What does that entail? Let's make some decisions about it. Let's make this actually gameable. And this is so well thought out that it actually anticipates on this page a lot of different properties and stories that are gonna come later in other forms of fiction about multiple dimensions. It's like a who's who of dimension hopping and time travel stories on this page, hitting those ideas before they were elevated into the spotlight of genre fiction. Like, okay, for example, we start with the idea of getting lost in the dimensions. It says that every time something happens in the universe, even on a subatomic level, it splits off into a different alternate reality, right? A different reality exists for every way it could have gone. Quote, "For this reason, it's not uncommon for dimensional travelers to become hopelessly and forever lost, doomed to spend the rest of their lives looking for that one particular home dimension lost in the haystack of possibilities." For those of you who didn't grow up in the 90s, this is Sliders. The show Sliders, it was a TV show on Fox where Gimli and the kid from My Secret Identity invent a dimensional travel device, and they go through a portal and they go to another dimension that's very much like their own, and then they got to keep going through dimension after dimension, and they're looking for their home, but they can never quite find it. And every time they show up somewhere, they're like, oh, maybe this is the place. But then there's a difference. There's something that's wrong here. So then they got to fix it a la Quantum Leap, just because, you know, they're hanging around, because they got to wait for the next portal to be able to open, because they got this little like remote control that opens a portal to other dimensions, but it only works sometimes. It's very much a transdimensional TMNT type show. That show started in 1995, 6 years after the publication of Transdimensional TMNT. But that's not all. Continuing on, this page offers some suggestions about different ways of setting up an alternate reality campaign. It offers three methods, called the GM Collection, the Branch Points, and the Palladium Option. And we'll get into these different methods in a minute, but just check out this note about how to implement different realities in your game. Quote, "A nifty thing to do is to include versions of your family, friends, and fellow game players as figures of importance in the various dimensional realities. Quote, hey, isn't that Jimmy's mom, the one they call Imperia, Empress of the United Earth? I want to point out that this book came out the same year as Back to the Future 2, where the characters of merely personal significance to Marty become significant and powerful figures in an alternate reality. And I want to point out, spoilers for Star Trek Enterprise, which I don't feel bad about at all because you shouldn't watch it. In the Mirror Universe episode of that show, the normally mild-mannered Hoshi Sato, the linguist on the ship in the regular universe, turns on the captain, seduces his personal guard, and then declares herself Empress Sato, ultimately taking over the Terran Empire, aka a united Earth. This is the basic idea of Back to the Future 2 and the very specific big twist of Enterprise's big alternate reality story, all before those things were in the popular consciousness, to the extent that Enterprise is in the popular consciousness. I know we're all trying to forget. Anyway, from there, the book goes on to describe the different ways of implementing alternate realities in your game. Number one is Game Master's Collection, which just amounts to decide ahead of time on a number of different realities you'd like to be in the campaign and just stick to that list. It's all preordained. You know what's out there. Your players can visit those places. Then it goes on, though, to option number two, branch points. And this is where you generate dimensions by determining when they split off from your main dimension, your Earth prime, so to speak. And then the page offers a number of different juncture points. They're on a random table, because of course they are, so that you can spontaneously create new realities. Option number one is that one dimension just started later or earlier than the other. So you can do something that's like time travel, but you're actually going between two different dimensions. It's just that in one of them, it's later because that dimension started first, but everything turns out the same way. So it's like using dimensional travel to sort of get a peek at your own future, but they're actually two separate timelines. A device like this was used in the episode of Justice League Unlimited called Legends, although it's complicated. But then the second option is, quote, "You can assume that the actual physical laws of the alternate universe are different. This creates some really wild possibilities where just about anything and any life form can happen. Just some of the possibilities include flat worlds, worlds where cartoon creatures are real, and worlds where thoughts and dreams always turn into reality. The first one is Flatland, if flat world means flat universe. Granted, Flatland significantly predates transdimensional TMNT, although it doesn't have woolly mammoths, so how good can it be really? The second one is like Cool World, also shades of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the film version of which came out the year before transdimensional TMNT, but based on the turnaround on the book, if that was an influence, it happened pretty quick. The film came out about 10 months before the book. And in any case, Cool World is the more apt analogy, and that film came out 3 years later. And a dimension where thoughts and dreams always become reality, I don't know. It's probably still years in the future. We still have not exhausted all of the possibilities represented on this page. And this is just the first page of a multi-page section offering idea after idea on how to run a multidimensional campaign, each one of which could be the basis of a whole campaign, or something else. Could be the premise of a film, could be the premise of a TV show, as we've seen. This is really, really good stuff. I think particularly the idea of a campaign like Sliders, where you're going to different dimensions, and each one of them has like a different juncture point. It has a different point in its history where things zagged rather than zigged, and that has consequences for what exists in that dimension. There's a whole table here supporting that. So there's like not only the idea of running Sliders many years before that show existed, because I know, you know, dimensional travel, parallel realities that are slightly different from our own, that idea existed. Like, the idea of a Dimension of the Week adventure series, I think, was not in the popular consciousness at this time. But notwithstanding that, the point is this book has not just the idea, but the backup. It's got tables, goddammit. It's got tables. So every time the players go to a different dimension, you can roll up. When did this reality diverge? What would that entail? And be ready to go. I mean, it's possible that I'm going to roll page 97 next time we have to do one of these, so I don't want to spoil it ahead of time, but most of the page is just a table of different historical periods where history could have diverged and what that would mean potentially for the present of that reality. Just a goldmine of great campaign ideas. I hope that we roll it. If not, you should go check it out yourself. If nothing else, if this podcast has achieved nothing else, I hope that it's encouraged everyone to go track down this out of print, illegal to sell book, because Transdimensional TMNT is absolutely worth having on your shelf. Anyway, that's it for Transdimensional TMNT for today. Join me next time for yet another page of mostly old equipment, and you know what that means, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 345 of Heroes Unlimited. We're still in the equipment section. We're still wading through equipment that we've seen before in Ninjas and Super Spies. Today's batch includes 5 different bug detectors, still no guns, a sensory equipment section, which actually does include a bug detector, which is cannily not located in the bug detector category, and the beginning of the emotion and stress detectors, which include a polygraph machine, a biomonitor system, and the psychological stress evaluator, a voice recording gadget that supposedly indicates when you're lying, but is actually bullshit. You may recall that we talked about this last gadget before. We've talked about most of this before. At least half of this equipment was already present in Ninjas and Super Spies in Season 1, and you know what that means. As we've been doing the last couple of days, it's time to delve into Transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and, in lieu of any new Heroes Unlimited business to talk about, discuss the most wonderful thing on a random page of this much better Palladium book. I'm rolling the dice now. I've rolled a 14, and that means we're going to be talking again about human mutants. Now, if you've been following the podcast since the beginning, you'll remember Radio Baby. You'll remember that this book contains rules for human mutants who have evolved away from what we think of as a normal human shape and physiology, with the result that in some cases they look like floating fetuses. Human mutants may also, however, lose certain features that we think of as typical to humans, like hands with opposable thumbs, or they may not have arms at all. evolution is a harsh mistress. However, as we all know from science fiction, what evolution taketh away from the body, it giveth to the big psychic brain. Thus, we have two special exclusive psychic powers only for human mutants who lack human appendages. They are in fact two variations on the same power, ectoplasmic hands. You may remember from the psionic section that despite their dumbness, I do love the ectoplasm powers. My only complaint about them is that as goofy and fun as it is to extrude this luminous material from your pores and use it to make little tentacles and stuff, it just isn't very practical for a lot of purposes. Now, finally, we've got a good use for ectoplasm. There's two versions of this. The first one is just ectoplasmic hands. Quote, a vaporous, luminous set of hands extend from out of the character's arms. These are agile and very sensitive. They have the equivalent of advanced touch with the same skill bonuses. The strength and reach of an ectoplasmic hand is exactly like that of a normal hand. Likewise, the size of the hand is proportional to the character's size level. It goes on to say, they work just like regular hands. Each one's got 10 SDC. If they get destroyed, you can't make them again for like 2d6 days because of the psychic feedback, and you have to maintain concentration on them. Mutants can only use one psychic power at a time when they're using mutant animal rules. So a human mutant who also has telepathy or whatever would have to drop the hands to use telepathy and vice versa. Somewhat of an interesting restriction. It helps avoid the non-disability disability that can sometimes be a problem in comic books. Like, you've got a character who theoretically is disabled or, shall we say, differently abled. I mean, this is a character with a totally different body plan, one that maybe isn't meant to have hands. It's not part of the standard body of the species. That's just not part of their physiology. It's not like they lost them in an accident. You want to play a character without hands, but you need some way to get around all of the impediments to adventure that come with that. So you replace it with a thing that makes it so that everybody forgets you don't have hands because it makes no difference. That's not very satisfying. Here you've got an alternative to hands that has a meaningful difference. You can only use one psychic power at a time, so your hands turn on and off. You use your hands when you have hands activated, but you can also grow them back if they're destroyed, and they're highly sensitive. And they glow, and they come out of your body like a luminous vapor. So all those are, you know, pros and cons. Overall, a really cool power. But it's more of a subtle sci-fi thing. Like, well, I say subtle. They're glowing gas hands at the end of your arm nubs. What I mean is, it's not a power gamer's fantasy. It's like a sci-fi concept that a creature would have no physical hands, but would have the psychic ability to manipulate things with virtual hands shaped from ectoplasm. It's not about power level. It's not like a crime-fighting ability. If you want that, you need to upgrade to the next power, extended ectoplasmic hands. Now we're really getting into some deep cuts from Radio Baby's crime-fighting arsenal. These things don't just have your normal reach. They reach 6 feet out. They can move through solid objects. So unlike the little ectoplasm tendril from standard Heroes Unlimited psionics that gets tangled on people's coats, and you know, if there's like a little kid in the room, you could accidentally get it tangled in their hair, and then you gotta go have an awkward conversation with their mom and pull all your extruded vapor out of the kid's hair. None of that shit here. Ectoplasmic hands can absolutely slap the shit out of you, but they can also pass through objects. Quote, this means the character can feel around inside closed boxes, reach into lock mechanisms, and trace the circuitry under the surface of a device. How cool is that? For the record, for one sentence of cool character options, like, none of it is super powerful. None of it is, you know, you're a psychic vampire who can do 70 hit points of damage every turn, blah, blah, blah. It's not that. It's just cool. I'm a psychic who can create a luminous vapor hand that comes out of my body and can reach inside of a locked box, inside of a lock to unlock it from inside from the mechanism, or run my fingers over the circuitry inside of an electrical object. So fucking rad. This, of course, gives you a plus 20% bonus to pick locks or repair electronics, which is great. A nice big chunky bonus, and appropriately so. Also, by the way, if feeling around inside closed boxes doesn't excite you as much as it excites me, you can also reach through the armor and flesh of another person. This gives you a plus 20% to medical skills because you can just reach right into people and fix their organs directly with your psychic hand. Or, if you are a destroyer by nature and not a healer, you can reach into people's bodies and just squeeze and punch their organs. These things do damage direct to hit points, firmly establishing the hierarchy of badassness in Palladium characters. You would think boxers would be number one, but no matter how hard you train, no matter how hard you box, a radio baby who can reach directly through your abs and punch your bare kidneys, that baby outranks you. Radio baby number one. I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you. I know we all took boxing, we're all invested in this, but it turns out radio babies are cooler than boxers. So yeah, you do direct hit points of damage in psychic fisticuffs, which is wonderful because you're like a little smooth floating chub loaf nobody thinks you're a threat. Then, all of a sudden, out of the sides of the chub loaf come glowing psychic arms, and they stretch out 6 feet like Dalsim and literally punch you directly in the heart. Not your chest, where your heart is, but directly in the heart. Punch, punch, punch in the heart. Direct damage to hit points. You're going down. Nobody fuck with this chub loaf, but you deserve it. That's the thing. If you've been messing with the floating chub loaf, because you thought you could get away with it, right? You were looking at the mutant tiger and the mutant bear and the mutant dinosaur, and you thought, I know what I'll do. I'll wait until those guys are distracted, and I'll go throw my weight around. I'll go lean on this little androgynous marshmallow baby. Well, you thought wrong. And now you're going to pay for it in organ meat. You might not even be able to run away. It says, should the victim of the attack go beyond the 6-foot range, he is safe. But hiding behind a door or fence may not be sufficient. The attacking psionic can move the hands through the locked door to feel for the character and attack again. This is like a horror movie now. You messed with the wrong chub loaf. Now you're running down the hallway. You lock yourself in the broom closet. And now here comes, just imagine it, here comes this glowing gaseous hand through the broom closet door, and Chub Loaf still can't see inside, but he's feeling around, he's feeling the brooms, he's feeling the mop bucket, he's feeling the cleaning supplies, big glowing fingers, and you've got your back pressed against the back of the broom closet, and you're like, oh god, oh god, oh god, I can't take another punch to the heart, let him pass me by. But then, horrifyingly, one finger finds your chest, and then it snaps up into a knife hand. 1-inch punch directly into your heart. You're dead in a broom closet, the way you deserve. Chub baby triumphant. God, I love transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It goes without saying that these ectoplasm powers are the most wonderful thing on this page. I can't say enough about the loving care that went into the bonkers shit in this game. I thought I loved Radio Baby before, but I've fallen in love all over again. Join me next time as we actually discuss an actual page of Heroes Unlimited due to the appearance of some new and very mysterious equipment on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 346 of Heroes Unlimited, and today we're in the equipment section. We've had a few days of just talking about transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because we've been talking about equipment that is found in Ninjas and Super Spies, so it's stuff that we've already talked about on the podcast. Today, though, less than 50% of the material here was found in Ninjas and Super Spies, which means, per my arbitrary but nonetheless inflexible rules, we do need to talk about this page. Get to talk about this page, really. Because there is a little idiosyncratic thing about this page, a detail unique to me that I'm going to bring you that kind of addresses like why I'm doing this podcast. I mean, Heroes Unlimited is interesting, I think. I think Ninjas and Super Spies is interesting too. It's interesting to look at why these very strange books are the way they are, what's contained within them, you know, plumb their secrets, things that probably even their authors were not fully conscious of. It's fun to make fun of what's dumb. It's fun to go back and find the really fun ideas and far-fetched concepts that made these things appealing to me as a kid and makes these books appealing to me now. But ultimately, I wouldn't have known there was something here in these books if I hadn't read them and fully absorbed them as a kid. I can't emphasize to you enough how much the very fabric of my childhood was defined by these books. I mean, I spent hours and hours and hours making characters for both Heroes Unlimited and Ninjas and Super Spies. I can readily think back to like the families going on a trip to the river. There's like this little campground where you can rent out an area for just the day and drive there and go swim in the river. And then, of course, being the person that I am, I'm like, fuck the river. Let me go play in their little video game shack that's got like a Mortal Kombat machine and some pinball. And I would take Ninjas and Super Spies with me. And like, can I make Kano in Ninjas and Super Spies? Sure I can. Hey, how about a ninja with power armor? Let me bring Heroes Unlimited. These are like childhood memories. And whenever I cast my mind back to me at a certain age, I'm always towing these books around. The impression that they made was deep. I mean, obviously. And sometimes that crops up in unexpected ways. So here's the thing about this page. Throughout the equipment section, as I noted this book up, I went in and I like highlighted the stuff that's in Ninjas and Super Spies. That allows me, number one, to tell, am I talking about this page or am I doing transdimensional TMNT? And also to identify the stuff that is fair game or most interesting to talk about. I want to talk about new material when I can. So other than some fairly dull cameras and AV equipment on this page, the main thing that appears here that isn't in Ninjas and Super Spies is some special sensory equipment. You know, this is for if your character is one of those scientist superheroes who likes to play science detective and solve crimes like Batman, or, you know, some versions of Dr. Midnight are like this, then these are the gadgets for you. First up is the portable laboratory. It's nearly 60 pounds. So, I mean, it's portable, but you've got to be devoted to science. You got to be willing to get up every morning, take your daily Percocet that you now need after years of schlepping this thing around, strap on your big chrome backpack with the atomic symbol on the back, give your lower back one good stretch, and get out there and do some science. 60 pounds is a lot to carry on a daily basis, but you get a lot for it. You get a microscope, specimen slides, an incubation chamber the size of a VCR. Imagine the dedication to science that it would take to go into the field every day with an incubation chamber. Or, I mean, maybe not even every day. Maybe your portable laboratory is for special circumstances, right? When you're on a science-related mission, you take the portable laboratory. Even so, incubation chamber is very specific. What's funny, though, about role-playing is that if you ask me how many times in the course of an adventure have I wished I had an incubator on me, the answer is not zero. And I think the same thing would be true of most superheroes in their careers, too. Like, haven't you from time to time run into a dinosaur egg? Haven't you at least once found a clutch of shocker lizard eggs after you cleared out the shocker lizard den? It sometimes happens. It's the life of an adventurer. So it's got an incubation chamber, it's got four burners, an instrument tray, a refrigeration chamber, an isolation chamber, a chemical cabinet, which contains lots of common useful chemicals, plus chemical analysis equipment. It's also got a centrifuge. It's got a dosimeter, or dosimeter, I don't know how that's pronounced. It's got a tape recorder, it's got a small computer, there's a camera in there, and a toxic analyzer, and the whole thing costs $62,000. I, for one, think this is amazing. This is like the thieves' tools of Heroes Unlimited, where particularly, if you started D&D the way that I pretty much did, like I played a little bit of AD&D, but I really started with 3.0. And if you look at the illustration of thieves' tools in that book, just seeing all those tools laid out, it's so tempting. I want every character to have thieves' tools. Even if I'm not playing a thief, or I'm sorry, a rogue, I still want to buy thieves' tools just because I want to have a saw, a hammer, a little pick, that cool roll-up leather case. It's just all great stuff to have. In the same way, even if I don't know science, just the panache of running into some alien eggs from the planet Zebu, and everybody's like, oh, what are we going to do about these alien eggs? And you're like, oh, no problem. Hold on. And you reach into your backpack and pull out an incubator. This is like scratching a very particular power fantasy niche for me. It's like after you watch The Goonies and you want to be the gadget kid, and so you start carrying a lot of shit around just to be prepared because you think it's going to make you look cool to the other kids. I'm not too proud to admit that part of me still exists. I sublimated into role-playing, but I want to be the guy who pulls out the incubator. I want to be the guy who the GM says, well, unfortunately, the alien engine requires a cesium core to function. Oh, cesium, you say? Womp. That's the sound of me pulling out my chemical cabinet and putting it on the counter in front of me. Cesium, cesium, ah, here it is. Of course I got a sample of cesium. Who the fuck do you think you're dealing with? I got a whole backpack full of science here. I'm ready for any occasion. It's a great, great gadget. I love the portable laboratory. But the portable laboratory is more for if you're like a hard science type character. Again, a Dr. Midnight, a character who's gonna like take a sample, put it on a slide, pull out a piece of real world science equipment, like a microscope, and do some real or plausible, at least, science. And I can get into that kind of character. It's probably my preference. But then again, I don't really know science. I mean, I'm trying to live out a fantasy where I went to school to learn about real things that exist in the world instead of fake things that exist in books. I want to indulge in the fantasy of being able to do math. I want to indulge in a sweet, sweet dream of having useful skills. But at the end of the day, I'm the guy who, to this day, has never clearly seen anything in a microscope. So I kind of have to settle for fantasy science. And there too, Palladium's got me covered. There's a much more fantastical device on this page. It is a, quote, uniquely comprehensive sensory device with full scanning capabilities. And full is in capital letters, and goddamn does it deserve them. This gadget has radar/sonar out to 5 miles. It detects radiation. It detects radar. It detects heat, infrared, ultraviolet, microwave. It's a long-range wideband radio. It's got a short-range communicator built in, so it's like one little walkie-talkie you can take away and communicate with the main set. It's got a video camera in there. It's got a, quote, audio-visual recorder using metal discs with digital meter, which I don't even know what that means, but it sure sounds like science, especially given it's 1998. Now it doesn't seem like a big deal to be able to record video with your sensor gadget onto a digital medium, but in 1998 you would have been burned as a fucking witch if you had recorded video onto something with no tape involved. There's even a tripod you can attach. Just like, you know, how nowadays we all carry around tripods to put our cell phones onto for when we really want to take quality video. This gadget costs about $75,000. Usually it's limited to scientific research or the military, it says. So if you're like a super spy type character, you might have one of these. Again, this is good for your like Wahoo Gonzo fantasy science character. This is not a character who would use a real microscope. That's for losers. This character just whips out his gadget, pushes some buttons, beep, beep, beep. I sense a high concentration of microwave energy. Let me home in on the source of the energy. Oh shit, it's Microwave Man. Now we know where he is, we can go beat the shit out of him. Thanks, science. I'm glad I brought you along. This gadget, while somewhat more grounded in reality, reminds one of nothing so much as a tricorder from Star Trek, but it's not a tricorder. It is a, quote, portable scan dihilator. That's D-I-H-I-L-A-T-O-R. Dihilator. A portable scan dihilator. Now, as I mentioned, I watched The Goonies. I pored over the Who's Who entry for Batman's utility belt. Yes, Batman's utility belt had its own entry in Who's Who. And I appreciated it. Thank you. I was that kind of kid. I liked being able to bust out some fantasy science in my role-playing game, so I would often equip my characters with these gadgets. And I was particularly impressed with the pinnacle of sensory technology that is the portable scan dihilator. So here's what happened. When I came to this page in the course of the podcast, I was sort of casting about for things to talk about on this page. And I thought, you know, the dihilator here is so cool. A real dihilator couldn't be this good, could it? Like, I understand that it's, you know, experimental military tech, but I bet what happened is there's some gadget that was deployed with the military that Kevin Sambita read about, and it's a prototype that never really quite worked and didn't have all these features, or maybe it was like technically man-portable, but you kind of got to drag it around on a cart. This has to be a fantastical version of the real portable scan dihilator, you know, that I foolishly believed could be this good in my youth. So let me look it up. Let me, you know what I'll do? I'll go to the Wikipedia page for scan dihilators, and I'll just find out what their real capabilities are, and I'll have great fun in this episode talking about how that dummy, Kevin Sambita, overestimated the abilities of a real, realistic scan dihilator. So, long story short, there's no such fucking thing as a scan dihilator. There, as far as I know, there's no such word as dihilator. I have believed, since at least the age of, let's say, 11 years old, that a dihilator is a piece of equipment that exists in the world that someone has, and I had only the shadowiest idea of who would have these. Like, I thought maybe, you know, military scientists in some way, or like, if there was like an Antarctic base, then, you know, the scientists who lived there would get together in their parkas like in The Thing and rub their hands together and, you know, drink their hooch that they smuggled into the base and be like, well, time to check out the dihilator and get some readings. Something like that, you know. I didn't think you could go buy them at the mall. I didn't expect to find any on Amazon, but I thought the dihilators were real. I had no reason not to. I've been reading about dihilators all my life in multiple different books. This is how ridiculously fucking simple the human mind is. Over the course of many years of my childhood, reading about portable scan dihilators in Heroes Unlimited, Rifts, other Palladium books that I borrowed from a friend, my stupid fucking human brain is like, that's like three books we've read about dihilators in. Obviously they exist. Ninjas have them, superheroes have them, ghost hunters have them, everybody has them. They're obviously real. Three books don't lie. Well, I'm here to tell you, three books do lie. If you look up dihilator on the internet, the only results that turn up, other than like pages of random words that may not exist, are references to Palladium books, leaving me to wonder, what the fuck is a dihilator? What is it supposed to be? When Kevin Sambita sits down and thinks, dihilator, what does he see? There's certainly no explanation of it here. It just says, quote, the portable scan dihilator is an uniquely comprehensive sensory device with full scanning capabilities. No other explanation is given. I mean, there's no weight, there's no size, it's something you can screw a tripod onto and carry around. That's all that I know. I think the psionic and magic sections really upped the ante with questionable game and book design decisions, but I've rarely been so baffled in the course of the podcast as I am with this. Where did Kevin Sambita get the portable scan dihilator? What is it? What is it supposed to be? I mean, I can surmise that maybe it was based on the tricorder from Star Trek, right? Tri, die, makes sense. But what's a hilator? I mean, do you think I didn't look up H-I-L as a root word? Of course I did. Of course I dug into the etymology trying to figure this out. To no avail. I know that in one book, I think it's a reprint of one of the Mechanoid Invasion books, and I shout out Glistem on Twitter, Dave Folmsby. I hope I'm saying his name right. It's off the top of my head. I interact with him all the time on Twitter. I reached out to people on Twitter to try to figure out where the dihilator first appeared, and he steered me in the right direction. It goes all the way back to the Mechanoid Invasion, and in one reprint of a Mechanoid book, It's referred to as a dilator rather than a dilator. So I guess at a stretch, we could say that dilator is an extremely long-lived misspelling of dilator, but I don't even want to think about how this thing is supposed to work if it dilates something. Now we got a speculum on a tripod. No, thank you. I want no part of this fantasy science. It's not my fucking fantasy. I think dilator has to be wrong. I think what happened is some editor somewhere along the way, finally someone was awake at the editing table at Palladium Books and was like, dilator, this isn't a word, must be dilator. But no, they're wrong. Dilator is its own ill-defined fantasy thing, apparently. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe I'm going to release this episode and I'm going to be flooded with comments saying, you fool, a dilator. Don't you know what a dilator is? I really don't. I thought I did. I've thought that I did for like 24 years. I really did. But in Googling for it, it just isn't anywhere. Here's the thing. Takeaway number one, don't just give random books to children. Because in this case, we're fortunate that it was harmless and that I just thought that there were such things as scan dilators. I didn't necessarily believe in the portable scan dilator, but I sort of marked it down in my mind to a non-portable scan dilator. Like, oh, that seems more realistic. But it could have been anything. And I would have believed it because I was that age and it was a book that I read again and again until my brain was just like, oh, okay, dilator, sure. And takeaway number two, what kind of mad genius is Kevin Zambita to sit down in a game like Heroes Unlimited, which is set in a world ostensibly like our own, right? It's got some advanced tech, but it's a world like our own. And the equipment section is full of stuff that is real and really exists. Who just sits down and puts into that a totally made-up thing? A piece of equipment from whole cloth that doesn't exist at all, with a name that comes apparently from nowhere. Just pure imagination. Kevin Zambita, the fucking Willy Wonka of role-playing games, just comes out with just pure creation. Just, boy, it'd be useful if you were an adventurer to be able to detect radiation and microwaves and radar and shit. I'm writing the equipment list. What would you use to do that? I know. A dilator. It's an object called a dilator. Are you a fucking wizard? Where did this come from? Just inventing words and shit? Goddamn. I'm the kind of person who wants to get to the bottom of things like this, as I guess is evidenced by my etymological search for some form of like reason or logic here. I want to know where things came from, but I'm always impressed by just raw creativity, just raw invention. Like, I love owlbears, I love mimics, I love oozes and golems, but I'm fascinated by the flump, you know? I'm impressed by the hook horror, you know? Or like, in Marvel Comics, I love what Jack Kirby did with, you know, Namor and Doctor Doom, but I'm blown away by the Silver Surfer because it's like, okay, God is a 20-foot man in a very tall hat who eats planets for breakfast, but he needs somebody to look for those planets. Who would look for those planets? Obviously, a chrome-covered naked man on a surfboard. This is an idea I would never have had. It's pure creation. That's what impresses me the most, I think. Now, you know, this is no Silver Surfer. It's no flump. But in its own way, I think the portable scan dilator shows that Kevin Zambita has some measure of this gift, that ability to just purely make shit up and put it on the page, that maybe is part of what makes his work so compelling despite its flaws. And it is flawed. I mean, the dumbest thing on this page, I have to admit, is simply making up a word with no explanation for a physical object, no less. Like, making up a noun for an object that you then proceed not to describe, and then using that made-up word and expecting the reader to know what the fuck you're talking about, that's like what we're seeing here. So that's dumb. But it's dumb in a way that I personally cannot begrudge. Like, we have one sap and one root. Let there be commerce between us, Kevin Zambita. I'm sitting here judging this questionable writing technique now as a person who believed until the year of our Lord 2019 that someone in the real world was running around with a scan dilator. So, like, who am I to judge? You know, this is me. This is who I am. It's part of the fabric of my life. So it's dumb, but, you know, I can't but embrace it. Today, we're discussing page 347 of Heroes Unlimited, a page of the book written for aliens. This page, part of the equipment section, was written under the assumption that you, the reader, are from the far reaches of space. You have no concept of human existence, and you need the mundane details of human life explained to you in extreme detail. But, owing to your advanced alien education and culture, there are other things that you just know implicitly. There's no need to talk about them because they're such elementary subjects to a scion of your noble race. That's the only explanation I can come up with for exactly how this page fills its space with such a bizarre, inexplicable farrago of unexplained and overexplained details. This is going to be a tough day to pick a dumbest thing, so let's just jump right in. The page starts with field equipment. This is stuff you would take out on a camping trip or an expedition into the wilderness, that sort of thing. And apparently, the author of this game envisioned a whole lot of outdoorsy crime fighting, because this is a very comprehensive list. Backpacks, blankets, canteens, climbing platforms, yet more knives, tents. This is not a complete list of everything in this section. These are just things that exist in multiple forms. These are just the items that offer options. All these things are on this list more than once. This list is granular enough that you can decide whether you want to buy a heavy or a light blanket, a large or a small backpack, a one-man, a two-man, a four-man, or a military command post tent, a large, a small, or a survival knife, an aluminum or a plastic canteen. I'm not saying there's no difference between a light and a heavy blanket, or between an aluminum and a plastic canteen. I would, of course, expect to see these options in an actual camping catalog, if I had, for whatever reason, decided to actually go camping. Doesn't sound like me, but I guess it could happen. But here, in the context of a superhero game, where I would remind you that many superheroes never go camping to crime fight. Like Peter Parker, my guess would be owns somewhere between 0 and 1 tents. And if I had to guess what kind, it would probably be whatever the artist feels like drawing. But we get excruciating detail about field equipment. Hey, you plan on eating in the woods? Perhaps I can interest you in a utensil kit for $25. What does a utensil kit include? I'm glad you asked. It includes a knife, fork, and spoon with sheath. Again with the fucking sheaths. It doesn't say here what it's made of. A glaring oversight. You just gotta use your imagination, I guess. Probably they ran out of space, is what happened. I wouldn't like to have been at that meeting where they had to tell Kevin Zambita, sorry, we're at the end of the book, we kinda ran out of pages, we had to cut all the guns. And he's like, well, I guess that's fine, just as long as we still have the utensil information, all the camping stuff. And the editor was like, oh, I hate to say it, but we did have to cut the detail on what the sheath is made of in the utensil kit. And then Kevin Zambita just fucking flipped the table, screamed out in rage, tore out his mustache with his bare hands. But yeah, at least the text still does explain to us what goes in a utensil kit. What utensils are we talking about here? Similarly, after field equipment is a list of containers you can buy. 37 lines of containers. In this book where there was no room for firearms, there are 37 lines of containers to buy. For example, just off the top of my head, a cask, wooden, 10 gallon. A cask, wooden, 25 gallons. A cask, wooden, 4 gallons. Or how about a cloth handle bag? No size is listed, but it costs $10. What's really important is that the handle is made of cloth. I think you'll agree that's the salient detail. Hey, how about 3 sizes of crate? How about 4 different jars? No one of which costs over $10, but nonetheless, we gotta track it. How many times in a role-playing game has the GM asked you the dreaded question? Oh sure, you've got a jar, but what's the volume of that jar? Oh shit, I knew I should have thought about this more carefully during character creation. I knew, I kind of glossed over it, and I really should have thought, am I going to need a 2-pint jar or a 4-pint jar or both? Or should I have bought a jar, glass? Which, by the way, what the fuck are the rest of these jars made of? Anyway, the details here, I can't understand. It has to be for aliens, because the very second container you can buy, quote, belt purse, and then in parentheses, attaches to belt. Yeah, no shit. A belt purse? On my belt? Who would have thought? Meanwhile, and you know what, call me an ignoramus, but under field equipment, I am offered a bear trap, a wolf trap, and a beaver trap. Not even a like a brief parenthetical explanation of what a beaver trap is. Is it just a smaller wolf trap? Is it more like a crab pot? I mean, I know, like I'm the ignorant one here. Kevin Zambita apparently knew what a beaver trap was. I don't. Go Kev. But neither now nor when I was a 12-year-old boy did I deal in fucking pelts. Why would I know what a beaver trap is? You could have explained it since you want to sell me one for, hold on, let me consult the list, $60. I mean, it costs $20 more than a rabbit trap. Can I extrapolate from that? I'm sorry, I just don't know what they are. But at least we firmly established what the belt purse attaches to. It's belts. I think I mentioned already we've got 3 more listings for knives, bringing our running total to 7 mechanically identical knives, 2 forms of itching powder, 2 backpacks, 4 jars, 3 jugs, 2 blankets, 2 canteens, 4 tents, 3 casks, 3 crates, and no firearms due to space limitations in this book. I mean, there was no space for guns. Hey, you know what? Here's an idea. Use a bow. Oh, and by the way, if you've got a bow, surely you're going to want the Bow Hunter accessory bag on offer on this page for $40. Of course, a Bow Hunter accessory bag. Every boy remembers his first Bow Hunter accessory bag. What the fuck is in a Bow Hunter accessory bag? I'm not saying they're not real, and I'm not saying they're not useful. I'm saying coming in at a strong number two on the list of things I don't kill animals with, right behind beaver traps, is bows. So why would I know what a bow hunter accessory kit has in it? No detail is given. No explanation. $40 bow hunter accessory kit. Like I'm supposed to know. But I guess if I'm from the alien planet Zebu, I would just know. I guess that because that's the target audience of this page. What I might not know is whether I can buy a disposable lighter. And if so, how much would it cost? This page lists a disposable lighter as costing $1. Thanks, book. I'm not going to say this is the single most useless line of text in this book, because that is a steep fucking competition. It's like the goddamn Olympics, but it's got to be in the running. One whole line in this overstuffed section, and all it says is, quote, disposable lighter, $1. I just want you to plunge your mind into the deep abyss of this single line. First of all, there's no information here except disposable lighters exist, and you can buy one for $1. That's it. Who accounts for disposable lighters during character creation? Have you ever created a character who smokes and then thought, boy, I better make sure that on my inventory, I've got a list of my disposable lighters? No, of course, if you smoke, you would have a lighter. And if not, then you probably have one at home. That's all. You don't have to subtract $1 from your starting equipment. Secondly, this is in the field equipment section, which, I mean, I guess it's useful to have a lighter outdoors, but I don't think of a disposable lighter as primarily a camping tool. Thirdly, in what scenario would I open this book and refer to this list to find out how much a disposable lighter costs? It's not a big ticket item. I think the GM could maybe extend me the courtesy of assuming that I have enough money to buy a disposable lighter, should I need one. And then later we can calculate the exact deduction from my detailed in-character bank statements and figure out how much I spent on that lighter. And finally, like just as an afterthought, disposable lighters don't cost $1. I mean, not consistently. Like, I understand that lighters vary in price, but if I were really tracking dollars and I were really worried about it, and I just needed to light a fire in an outdoor survival situation, and I'm like down to my last $5 because apparently I'm playing that broke-ass wizard superhero from the magic section, and I'm like, oh, a disposable lighter, you say? How much you want for it? I gotta get this cloak patch too. I'm not made of credits, I mean dollars. In that scenario, I can find a lighter for less than $1. If the GM even holds my feet to the fire about it, which why would he? It's $1. At the point when, if it turns out my character doesn't have enough money to buy something, I could go look around on the ground outside the store and find some change and buy it. What are we doing here? But not only are we taking up table time with this, presumably, it's taken up a whole line of this book. Unbelievable. Just skimming through this, other random items that are on sale. Pillow, $10. Sack, large, $15. Sack, small, $6. No mention of relative size or material or anything like that. How is this different from a knapsack for $25? I'm not exactly sure. Saddlebag, parentheses, horse, $100. This is the only saddlebag listed. If you want to ride a donkey, you've got to go buy a supplement. Get out of here with that shit. We don't have room in the core rulebook. But can I interest you in either a large or a small shoulder purse? Different from a knapsack. I'm surprised there's no parenthetical statement about which body part you use to carry a shoulder purse. Tobacco pouch, $20. Three sizes of water skin. We did have room for snare cord, which is sold mysteriously in units of square yards. Again, I'm not a hunter, which is presumably who these are for, even though if you Google snare cord, what comes up primarily is drum equipment. So I don't really know what a snare cord is. I don't know why it would be sold in square yards. And I have no idea why, if I wanted to make some kind of snare, I guess because I can't afford a wolf, bear, beaver, or rabbit trap, I don't know why I would need to use a specific snare cord as opposed to some other kind of cord or like rope or chain or string or whatever, anything else that's on sale. And there's no explanation. I'm just expected to know what a snare cord is and why it's sold in squares. It's very hard to pick a dumbest thing on this page, but I think ultimately I have to go with the parenthetical note next to belt purse that it attaches to the belt. On a page that expects so much knowledge from me about beaver hunting, about sheets of snare cord, to take the time out in a parenthetical to explain to me that a belt purse goes on a belt really, like, drives home what an absolute torrent of nonsense this page is. But then that bow hunter accessory bag, what could be in it? Why would you put it here and not give any explanation of what's inside? And why waste a whole line on the disposable lighter? That's one you could have cut completely. And it's wrong. I don't know. I have to move on. I'm sticking with the belt purse. But honestly, I think 90% of players would not notice or feel slighted whatsoever if you cut the entire field equipment and containers section. I mean, honestly, who buys fucking casks in a superhero role-playing game? You could have cut them completely. This half page alone is enough for those firearms you couldn't fit into the game. It's unbelievable the choices that were made here. Anyway, I have to move on. Join me tomorrow as we try to make some kind of sense out of the madness and talk about the types of things that are in this equipment section and the types of things that are not on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. Contact or check out the show wherever you want. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. MDC, Palladium Books, Heroes Unlimited, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Sambita. This season's theme song is To the Top by Midair Machine, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org/music/askagain. The transdimensional TMNT theme, used under a Creative Commons license, is Acapulco 2000 by Jack Fetterman in the In Hi-Fi Music Direction, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.